Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks for listening. Today on the podcast, Vegan Aharonian, senior teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. He's been on the podcast in episodes past. This was a talk he gave at our weekly Dharma gathering a couple weeks ago about Shambhala. What is it? What is it about? How is it situated within the world of Buddhism and the world of meditation, various meditation teachings and different kinds of meditation traditions? This is a great overview, a great orientation to what the Shambhala Meditation Center is all about. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, to see all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. In particular, our introductory Shambhala Weekend, Shambhala Meditation Weekend, which is called Shambhala Training Weekend 1. It happens 6 times a year, once every other month. The next time it's happening is March 2nd, the weekend of March 2nd, with Dr. Shante Smalls, another regular to the podcast. And this is also a great way to dive into the meditation curriculum by doing this introductory Shambhala training weekend either in March or at a future date. You can always come just to the Friday night introductory talk and see what it's about and then decide at that time or a later time to do a full weekend. And now, Vegan Aharonian.
Shambhala, the word Shambhala, which we use for the organization, and it also belongs to the teachings, Shambhala teachings. They come, some of you may have known, there was legendary country or real country that depends of a perspective, but there was a country in Asia called Shambhala. It existed at the time of the Buddha. And when Buddha was teaching his teachings, the typical mode of following his teaching was to abandon your daily life and become a monk. People would leave their families, their houses, and go to monasteries and follow. And Buddha had gradually had many monasteries around India. And one day the king of Shambhala, King Dawasangpo, came to Buddha and asked him. He said, I want to follow your wisdom, your teachings. I want to practice them. I want to learn them. But I can't become a monk. I have a family. I have my country. They depend on me. And I want to have my life enjoyments. I don't want to take the ascetic life necessarily. But I want to practice the wisdom you have to share. Is there a way that I can incorporate the philosophy you are teaching into my daily normal life? And so Buddha presented him these teachings called Kalachakra Tantra. King Dawasangpo understood the teachings in full depth and then went back and taught his ministers and subjects, and eventually the whole country was practicing these teachings we call Shambhala teachings. And as the story goes, then the whole country got enlightened and left the physical manifestation as we perceive it. So the teachings are rooting there. These are teachings for people like us who have busy lives, are engaged in jobs, families, personal relationships, and so on. And yet we want to infuse all that with some wisdom, meaning uplifted in some way. As a matter of fact, the image right in the middle, it's Rigdon. Rigdon is the image of the king of Shambhala in principle, it's a king of Shambhala. There were many kings that followed Dawa Sangpo, and they were called Rigdans. But it also represents anybody, all of us. It's an image of householder yogi or yogini. Somebody who has a household and tries to achieve enlightenment while having a busy life. You might notice that the facial expression is not clear. Is it a man or a woman? So it's intentionally done that it's not necessarily masculine or feminine. In principle, everybody has some masculine energy and feminine energy and in some proportion. And so Rigdan is not necessarily male. So that's the image of the Shambhala teaching. We want to be want to be able to infuse our daily life with some wisdom, clarity, and everything you learn in Shambhala teachings. How did they come to U.S.? On my right, shrine right, is Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He was born in Tibet and left Tibet when he was 19. He was a very prominent Tibetan Lama. He was heading a network of monasteries, Sarmang monasteries. And when he was leaving Tibet, he felt that Shambhala teachings, and he knew a lot of, he had a lot of teachings in his, he was a genius learner, and by 19 he knew a lot of schools of Buddhism. And so he felt that Shambhala teachings are very important for this day and age. And he eventually he came to U.S. in 1970, and he established the organization, the Shambhala International Organization. Initially, he was teaching traditional Buddhist teachings, and then in 1976, he felt it's time to introduce Shambhala teachings and started teaching Shambhala teachings. And now his son, the Sakyong Mipon Rinpoche, develops this further and develops in the sense that the philosophical core is there. You don't develop it. You develop the methodology, how you presented the curriculum, the skillful means, as we call them, the skillful means how to make it accessible and help people understand, apply in their lives and grow. There are a few important concepts that Shambhala teachings are based on. And those of you who read something and took some programs probably heard the notion of basic goodness. Yes, familiar? Basic goodness is a fundamentally very important notion. I'll spend a little time now explaining what do we mean by that. But the more you go through the teachings, the deeper you understand. It's a multifaceted notion, and so I'll try to introduce to the first few steps, but I can't do it justice in one talk at all. When we say basic goodness, we mean that basically, fundamentally, every human being is wholesome, worthy of respect. We do have all we really need. This attitude that particularly Western society has, that I'm not good enough, I have to accomplish this, this, and that to feel dignified enough, to earn respect. I have to exercise more, I have to have this many degrees, I have to reach this level of material wealth, and on and on and on and on and on, right? We have different combination of things we feel we're missing. Once I get there, then everything will be fine. We live with that from childhood. When I go to graduate from kindergarten to school, I will be big then. That will be a different life. When I I don't know, get a GPA in high school above a certain number, that will be an accomplishment. Then I can feel I am something. And on, right? In college, we want to have status with friends. Then we want to get a good job, get married or get divorced or whatever we wait to happen in order to finally get somewhere. When we talk about basic goodness, we say everything you really need, you already have. Everything else is just a game which we can play, but without that sense of being insufficient, incomplete. Does it make sense? We say that everybody is born with it. You don't have to fight for it. You don't have to prove to anybody you have it. It's something to feel you have. You get in touch with. And there are a lot of consequences from that. If we accept that fundamentally I'm okay, whatever happens, I can deal with it. I don't have to win every game necessarily, and I'm still worthy human being. And it's not just about me necessarily. Basic goodness is not necessarily I have basic goodness. It's life in principle is fundamentally, basically okay. And good also doesn't mean it's not bad. It's okay the way it is. It's complete. It's worthy. We're not even asking, is it good or bad? It's the way it is. It's workable. I can deal with it. There is nothing to really complain about in a significant way. Yeah, we can complain that it's raining, I'm cold, but that's a minor thing. Fundamentally, in its root, it's okay. It's supposed to rain from time to time. I'm supposed to fail at some projects. That's game of life. That's normal. It would be wrong if it wasn't that way. If we accept that in some, not just intellectually, not just theoretically, but feel fundamentally relaxed in our own skin, then our attitude not only towards us, but towards circumstances and people around us can change. The life can be more playful and interesting, a field to play rather than keep trying to prove something to myself or others. I recently came across to a speech that Charlie Chaplin. Does everybody know who was Charlie Chaplin? Yes, because I grew up in a different country. Once I played a Beatles song on teachings here, and then people ask, what was that? And I was really surprised. How can someone not recognize a Beatles song? So sometimes I think maybe I'm too ancient and don't recognize it anymore. But anyway, so Charlie Chaplin, just in case, was a famous actor. And he was English, but I think he lived in US for the later part of his life. So on his 70th birthday, apparently, he gave this talk. This is not a long talk, but I am not going to read it all. These are 10 statements that he made. And the reason, by the way, I thought it's important to bring, he obviously had nothing to do with Shambhala. Shambhala organization didn't exist then. But this wisdom is pretty universal. And I'll talk more about how Shambhala teachings are different from the rest of the Buddhists, but wisdom is universal. It doesn't belong to Buddhism or any other philosophy or religion. So genius people can feel it in their own experience. I'll read just a few of the statements he made. He made 10 statements. I picked 4 for today. And each of the statements starts with a phrase. He says, as I began to love myself. And I think we can replace that as I began to recognize basic goodness, because otherwise everything fits. When I began to recognize basic goodness. So the first statement is, as I began to love myself, I stopped craving for a different life, and I could see that everything that surrounded me was inviting me to grow. Today I call it maturity. And that's exactly what we teach in Shambhala teachings, that we don't need to keep dreaming of a different life. The life we have is perfectly fine. Yes, we need to deal with different situations, and that's perfectly fine. As I began to love myself, I understood that at any circumstance, I am in the right place at the right time, and everything happens at that exactly right moment. So I could be calm. Today I call it self-confidence. Again, we often, when we end up in unpleasant situations, we might think, why me? Why? We find a guilty person who put us there. We get upset and wish we weren't there. From Shambhala teaching's point of view, that's irrational and unnecessary. We are there because there is something to learn from the situation. And if we drop the complaint and just look clearly at what's going on, then we will have enough energy and clarity of mind to deal with it the best we can, rather than lose energy on complaint. As I began to love myself, I refused to go on living in the past and worry about the future. Now I only live for the moment, where everything is happening. Today I live each day, day by day, and I call it fulfillment. That's what we do, we train to do when we meditate. We learn to, we train our mind to be present, to be engaged with what happens right now. When we're sitting on the cushion, that's the breath, that the body, we want to come back to that sense of synchronicity. I like the word synchronicity, feeling synchronized with the body. That's what we train when we meditate those 10, 15, 20 minutes. But we want to maintain that throughout our activities throughout the day. We want to be present with whatever happens in the conversations we have, in the projects we work on, when we walk in the streets. We want to see people around us. Life is colorful and interesting. We don't have to keep running ahead of ourselves and planning ahead and trying to optimize our activities. That's what I do a lot of times. We can live fully with what happens right now, fully engaged. That would save a lot of energy and will make what happens now interesting rather than keep hoping for something more exciting to happen in the future. As I began to love myself, I recognized that my mind can disturb me and it can make me sick. But as I connected it to my heart, my mind became a valuable ally. Today I call this connection wisdom of the heart. When we talk about this idea in Shambhala, we speak about being in touch with our heart. Actually, Shambhala training level weekend 4 is specifically about that. But being in touch with what we feel is also important. We have some notion from our upbringing how we are supposed to feel. What feeling are we supposed to accept, and which ones are not right feeling? We either pretend we don't have them, or we suppress them, or we run away from them. We try to do something not to feel that. It takes quite some bravery and open-mindedness to let yourself feel the way you feel and be curious about it. Not try to manipulate it, fight it, run away from it. Just be present with the feelings you have. Be in touch with your heart. And that's another very important fundamental notion we cultivate through Shambhala teachings. So that all goes into notion of basic goodness. If we accept the basic that we're fundamentally good, the life is fundamentally good. We are relaxed enough and free enough to accept what I just spoke about, and then life become an interesting game to play rather than something to fight against. We have also in Shambhala language, we have a notion of warrior. So we're Shambhala warriors. In what sense do we mean the warrior? A warrior is somebody who is willing to feel the feelings, I just spoke about that, willing to be honest with ourselves, willing to step into unpleasant, unfamiliar territory. It's bravery. That's the bravery of Shambhala warrior. To bravely accept the life the way it is and do the best we can and let ourselves be who we are. That's another very important thing. We want to be different. We present ourselves to outside world somewhat different. We pretend to be smarter, more productive, and so on. In various scenarios, we have a different image to hold. If we could relax and just be ourselves, it will be so much easier, not only for ourselves, but others as well. But that takes bravery. That's the warriorship we talk about in Shambhala. To be a warrior is to be willing to be who you are and feel what you have to feel, what there is to feel. And then we have notion of enlightened society. Remember when I spoke about Shambhala, the country, society was practicing the teachings and got enlightened. So we are cultivating enlightened society. What is enlightened society? It's not a concept of accomplishment. It's not the society that got enlightened. It's more about the process than the result. Generally, life is about process, not the result. And so that's what we cultivate in enlightened society. It's society of warriors, people who are willing to try, people who are working on themselves. Working on themselves is harsh, no. Who are playing with themselves, who are willing to try. That's what, and help others to they radiate that willingness to others, that bravery to others, and help their fellow society members to do the same. If I drop my guard, if I don't have any armor to protect my softness, weakness, my vulnerability, everybody might have noticed. When somebody is dropping their protection. They are not trying to defend themselves. They are willing to accept they were wrong. It kind of makes you soft too. You don't want to attack them anymore, right? And that's what we want to cultivate. When each of us in the society behaves that way, if we try to drop our defensiveness, then it helps the others drop their defensiveness, and then it becomes much more pleasant to interact. That's what we mean by enlightened society. People who help each other on the way, on the path. It doesn't mean that everybody has to sign up to be a Buddhist. It's not a society of Buddhists necessarily. Everything I said so far is probably, and as far as I know, is pretty acceptable applicable to atheists, Jews, Christians, Muslims. And we had in Shambhala priests and rabbis . I don't remember personally anybody from Islam to take the training, maybe, but I haven't spoken. But I have spoken to Christian priests from different schools, I should say. What do they call them? They're denominations, yes. Who felt perfectly comfortable in Shambhala, who continue to teach Christianity in various denominations and didn't see any contradiction. I have spoken, a woman who was taking my course, and she said she's a rabbi in a, well, when she I was surprised she's a rabbi, but she said it's in a reform synagogue. And she says that she comes to Shambhala teachings to enrich what she says when she is teaching as a rabbi. That helps her to be a better rabbi. So Shambhala teachings are pretty open in that way. How are we different from the Buddhism in general? Let me say a few words about traditional Buddhism. And we come from Tibetan Buddhism. In Tibet, there are four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism, Gelugpa, Kagyu, Nyingma, and Sakya. Dalai Lama is the head of Gelugpa school, by the way. And Shambhala teachings are coming from two schools which are particularly close to each other, Nyingma and Kagyu. As a matter of fact, these two teachers, the pictures, the Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche and Sakya Mipon Rinpoche, they both are trained in both schools. They are masters in both schools. And the Shambhala teachings are rooted in both schools, but it is a separate school. It's a sub-school, you can think of it that way. So the core philosophy that is there are Buddhist thoughts. But if you go to another Buddhist center that has nothing to do with Shambhala and say basic goodness or enlightened society, they won't recognize them at all. These are specific Shambhala terminology. When Chogyam Trungpa came here in 1970, and after 6 years of observing our life here, he kind of developed the language. There was the philosophical understanding from Buddha's time. But the language we use here was developed by him. The terminology, the curriculum we teach, I'll speak about curriculum soon, he developed it based on his understanding of Western psychology, how our mind works, how we function in daily life. He understood it quickly. Because Buddhism is such a psychoanalytical, subtle psychoanalytical system, I never perceived Buddhism as a religion, and even as a philosophy, it's a psychoanalytical system. That's how I take it, that's how I study it. And so being a very subtle psychoanalyst, he understood how we function here in the West very quickly, and so he developed the curriculum to fit the need of the modern society. And he knew that this is... Well, he felt it even when he left Tibet. I said that earlier, that Shambhala teachings are very important for the current, for the civilization at this stage of development. And so when he came to U.S., he thought that that's the most important offering he can give to us. And so he developed the organization and the teachings so it can improve the state of the society as we go. How are we different from traditional Buddhist teachings? I think that what I said about enlightened society, that's what makes us different. And what I said about the household situation, that these teachings are formulated for people who are busy and have speedy lives, and want to bring some space into that speedy life. So what's interesting is the speediness of life is not as much because we are engaged in a lot of things. That's true too. But we make it even speedier because we run around in our heads too fast. You can do things, a lot of things in a unit of time fast, but if your mind is synchronized with your action, it doesn't feel so speedy. I have that experience from athletic activity. Sometimes you have to do something very quickly. You play a game, you run, let's say it's a team game, a ball game, you throw. If your mind is very synchronized with your body, you feel your body movement, and even though you move very quickly, it doesn't feel so quickly. There are moments when it's like in slow motion. You see the ball flying or whatever you do, the pack or whatever you do. There are moments when it's fast, but your mind is so synchronized it feels like in slow motion. If we could function like that throughout the day, seeing all the details at the same time, feel your body engaged. That's what enlightened mind can do. The fact that we have glimpses of that, by the way, that's such an important thing. We have glimpses of that in our ordinary being lives. That means it's accessible to us. Enlightenment is accessible to any human being. The mind is trainable. And that's another thing, that we're basically fundamentally perfect the way we are. We have the potentiality. There is no need to complain about every little thing we run into. Well, a lot of this is part of traditional Buddhism too. They would use a different language to explain this. There is a notion of Buddha nature. Traditional Buddhism uses language or like Buddha nature to explain something we call basic goodness. But I think if you go to traditional Buddhist teachings, there might be notions that you might not feel that easy to accept. A reincarnation, for example. It's an important Buddhist notion. A lot of logic of Buddhist philosophy is based on acceptance, the fact that our consciousness reincarnates, gets reborn. Shambhala teachings don't rely on that, but we do accept that too. Again, here is we are in gray territory. If you accept the notion of reincarnation, it's kind of the philosophy makes more logical sense. If you go far deeper where we are now, when you take training, somewhere down the road we get to subtleties, philosophical subtleties of why this and why that, where it becomes an important question. But for practical reasons, to live your daily life, you don't have to go there, that subtle. I want to say that here at Shambhala we do have courses that are called Buddhist studies, where we teach traditional Buddhist studies and we draw bridges between Shambhala teachings and Buddhist studies frequently. And there we do discuss why reincarnation is important, but it's something that is really down the road if you go there and you don't have to go there. I think I've said enough about this. I have to talk a little bit about curriculum, how we teach these teachings, but I want to offer you ask a few questions here if you want, like three questions maybe.
Hello. So for the past 6 years, I've been dealing with a lot of chronic pain and other health issues. And my solution was always to avoid it and distract myself away from reality. And when that finally came crashing down, I guess I've started the really slow, tough process of trying to accept basic goodness. And I guess my question for you would be, how, I know it's an impossible question, but how am I able to do that when my body is telling me something's wrong and I can't do anything about it?
Yeah, thank you. Life can be painful at times. In your case, you're saying it's chronic, so it's 6 years continuously in pain. It's very difficult. I never had chronic pain, so I can't say from personal experience. I can only try to visualize how it might be. But what I can offer here is, well, you have to deal with the pain and find solutions and maybe take painkillers, and you don't have to say, all right, this is perfectly fine, I have to be in pain. You need to do what you have to do, whatever seems reasonable to do at any given point. Yet, you don't have to think of yourself as you are miserable, and how do I put this better? That your life is a failure. Maybe that's a better way. There is something to learn from this, to do this, whether you can ever solve this problem or not. After all, eventually we are all going to die. This life has we have limited time here. And everybody is some form of suffering. I'm not saying everybody has the same level of suffering as you do. We have different levels of suffering and we perceive them differently. I remembered an interesting situation. 16th Karmapa, who was the head of the Kagyu lineage. I said Dalai Lama was the head of the Gelugpa lineage. Kagyu lineage's head, it was Karmapa's, or now it's 17th Karmapa. The 16th Karmapa, last period of his life, he lived here in U.S., and he had cancer. Was it pancreatic cancer? I don't remember. Some kind of cancer. He was dying of cancer. He was in a hospital in Chicago last weeks of his life, and so his students were attending him, and he refused any painkillers. The doctors were amazed how he can handle. They said it's a very, very painful type of cancer. He didn't want any painkillers. And when one of his students, the way they describe, he was sitting next to him and crying of his teacher dying, and the teacher said, nothing happens. And he didn't display any signs of suffering too. He was, if you are an enlightened being, you can feel the pain and yet you are not associating that with suffering. It's kind of a reality of your experience. You don't have to, I'm not saying I could do it, and I'm not saying you have to feel guilty if you can't. I'm just saying that theoretically speaking, it's possible to feel pain and not think of that as suffering. You can obviously feel that as an extreme discomfort, but not necessarily feel that I'm suffering. I'm experiencing pain. It feels uncomfortable, unpleasant, whatever you want to call it. It's not necessarily equating with suffering. I'm observing an unpleasant state of life. In your case, it's continuous. Does it help in any possible way? Well, it was a long answer, yes. Maybe the battery. Well, if you speak loudly, we'll hear. dissipate, you said? Will the, if you are enlightened, will the physical or mental pain dissipate? If I was enlightened, I would tell you for sure. From what I heard in various teachings, if you are enlightened, it does not mean you don't have emotions. As a matter of fact, they might be even more colorful. It's the difference, or physical pain either. The difference is that what's your attitude towards that? And that's what I just spoke about. You might feel, if you are enlightened, these are different colors of life. Let's say you like green and don't like brown. When you see brown, you are not in pain. You dislike the color, but you perceive the color. Okay, so that's the color I don't like. I'm not saying it's as easy as when you are in pain or not. Definitely not. But if you are enlightened, in my understanding, that's the difference. Okay, this is unpleasant feeling, but that's part of my colorful life. One story was in a monastery, a big teacher died, and his student, who was also a teacher, was crying at the death of his teacher. And the monk was asking this crying teacher, "You are such a big teacher, why are you crying? Why is your attitude?" And he said, "Well, I'm crying because my teacher died and it feels sad, so I'm crying." And the point there is, if I'm enlightened, doesn't mean I don't get sad. It's being alive, part of being alive. It would be very uninteresting to live if we didn't have those emotions.
I just have one more question. When you told a story about Shambhala itself, you said that the people became enlightened, and they were so enlightened, and they were able to leave this earth. So if you're able to leave the earth, how could you not be able to make pain disappear?
You see, the question is bigger. I don't think they left the earth as a method to let go of pain. Or even with the enlightened person, let me go back to green and brown. If you don't like brown and suddenly you come across brown, you don't necessarily make brown disappear or turn around. You can look at the brown, okay, it's brown, the color I don't like. You don't need to fight with it. So when you are enlightened, you are above that. You don't leave the earth because you don't want to feel pain, or you don't stay because you want. It's irrelevant. It's pain, no pain. There is no real difference. So maybe they could, but there is no point. I mean, maybe they could dissipate the pain while they are here, but it's not that important for them to do so. Or maybe they do sometimes. I don't. They are above that anyway. They might make it dissipate. They might not do it dissipate. The same way you might turn away from brown, or you might not turn away from brown.
Hi, Vegan. I actually wanted to reflect on what the gentleman over here said about chronic pain. Is that okay to just throw something out there? Because you talked about an enlightened being, how they might experience, but I'm sort of trying to take it back down to the everyday struggles that we all have. I just wanted to say I've experienced a lot of chronic pain as well, and I get it. It's really, I'm sorry you're going through that. And I have found through meditating and through this process, deepening my practice here, that my chronic pain has definitely lightened, and I've been able to let go, and mostly because of, Vegan, what you were saying about basically the story that I put on it, with pain or with strong emotions, that like I can have the pain, and if I just notice it, it actually dissolves. But if I go, that hurts, I shouldn't feel that way, you know, or I better get a massage, or why, and you know, I get into the story, that's like an extra bonus of pain, as they say. So I just wanted to share that because I felt like it might be helpful.
Yeah, thank you. That's actually a classical Buddhist advice. When you feel pain, try to fully feel it, be there present with the pain, with a sense of curiosity. And as they say, yes, you are experienced, it doesn't feel as painful when we are willing to experience it. But again, you should deal with reality that you have to deal. We can only give some advice. All right, thank you very much. Everybody's already eating. Yes, thank you all.
Yeah. Thanks, Vegan. Thank you for listening to the podcast. I hope this answered some of your questions about what Shambhala is all about. Obviously, it's a big topic. The best way to learn is to just go to a Shambhala Center. If you have one in your town, come to the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York if you're in the New York area. Or if you're in another city, there's probably one near you. Look us up. There's usually some kind of open house type situation. Every Tuesday night at the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is our weekly Dharma gathering where you're invited. You can come, hear these talks live and in person, and get a sense of what happens at the Shambhala Center of New York. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions. Tell your friends about the podcast. Thanks for listening. Later.